Here on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week and a reading from the new biography of T.S. Eliot. Tom enjoys the support of Virginia Woolf, meets James Joyce, and there's the emergence of his most famous poem in Young Eliot by Robert Crawford.
In 1918, Tom received an important letter from Leonard Woolf. The Woolf's friend, Roger Fry, had mentioned to them that Tom was seeking a publisher for some poems. Leonard and Virginia had very much liked Prufrock. Would Tom allow them to look at his new poems with a view to having them published by the Hogarth Press? 6 years Tom senior, Virginia Woolf found this foreign visitor a strange young man. After first meeting him, she set down a penetrating impression in her diary. Mr. Eliot is well expressed by his name, a polished, cultivated, elaborate young American, talking so slow that each word seems to have a special finish allotted it. But beneath the surface, it is fairly evident that he is very intellectual, intolerant, with strong views of his own, and a poetic creed. I'm sorry to say that this sets up Ezra Pound and Wyndham Lewis as great poets. He admires Mr. Joyce immensely. He produced 3 or 4 poems for us to look at, the fruit of 2 years, since he works all day in a bank, and in his reasonable way thinks regular work good for people of nervous constitutions. Within 4 months, she would handset some of his lines of verse for her printing press, then print and bind by hand his small pamphlet, entitled simply, Poems. The poems Tom gave the Woolfs were Sweeney Among the Nightingales, The Hippopotamus, Mr. Eliot's Sunday Morning Service, and Whispers of Immortality. To these he added 3 others in French, Le Spectateur, Mélange Adultère de Thou, and L'Urn de Miel. An unnamed reviewer in the Athenaeum maintained that the poetry of the dead is in his bones and at the tips of his fingers. He has the rare gift of being able to weave, delicately and delightfully, an echo, or even a line of the past, into the pattern of his own poem. This might have been dictated by Tom. On Tuesday, the 7th of January, 1919, Tom's father died. Vivian received a cable around noon on Wednesday. Wisely, she kept the news to herself until Tom got home from the bank. When she told him, he felt poleaxed. He had not seen his father for over 3 years. That Thursday, in St. Louis, the funeral was held at the Church of the Messiah. The next day, Tom wrote his mother a short letter. I do long for you. I wanted you more for my sake than yours to sing the little tailor to me. However troubled, life went on. As it happened before, illness helped him release poetry on which he had been brooding. His new work would draw on worries about a wasted life, which his father's death intensified. It was fed, too, by a failure to fight in war, by a sense of utter exhaustion, by trepidation about how the peace might turn out, by ongoing anxieties about sex, religion, and death. It involved everything from hot, dry weather to Tom's absorption in Elizabethan, Victorian, and American literature. Even texts for his evening classes and his reviewing activities were raided with magpie alertness to fuel this poem, which he completed during the summer of 1919. Soon, the title for the poem became Gerontian, a term used by Aristophanes and Xenophon, meaning little old man, typed out not long after his Greek-loving father's interment. Gerontian announces its sense of witheredness right from the start.
Here I am, an old man in a dry month, being read to by a boy, waiting for rain.
That rain never seems to come. The poem ends with a dry brain in a dry season. It is an anatomy of exhaustion. He felt acutely the indestructible barriers between one human being and another. This may have made him hard to understand as a person, even for Virginia Woolf. Having the Elliots to Sunday lunch with other visitors on the 6th of April, Virginia decided Tom had become sharp, narrow, and much of a stick since he took to disliking me. As tensions flowed and ebbed, his pamphlet, Poems, with a cover designed by Roger Fry, appeared on the 12th of May. Behind Tom's back, Virginia explained to a friend, "Mr. Elliot is an American of the highest culture, so that his writing is almost unintelligible." Tom was considering a foray to rural France, maybe visiting Ezra Pound and going on a walking tour before rendezvousing with Vivian in Paris. Possibly he could contact anybody worth seeing in the French capital, and particularly because they had not yet met James Joyce. Wyndham Lewis and Tom went to France on Saturday, the 14th of August. Tom had dashed off a hasty letter to Joyce on the Wednesday, saying he would be staying on Sunday night at the Hotel de l'Elysée on the left bank, where Joyce himself, Pound, and other avant-garde figures had resided. Entrusted with a brown paper package from Pound, a gift for the Irish novelist, Tom wondered if they could meet for dinner that evening about 6:30. There was no time for Joyce to reply, but he turned up with his son Giorgio, and Tom handed him the parcel. When Joyce unwrapped it, he found inside a second-hand pair of brown shoes. "Oh," he exclaimed, very faintly. Lewis, Joyce, Tom, and the art critic Fritz van der Peil all dined together at a nearby restaurant. Carrying a straw boater, Joyce was their generous host, tipping the waiter munificently, but saying nothing specifically memorable. Wanting to record something of this dinner, Tom sketched the scene in a letter. The four men in hats, Joyce with goatee beard and spectacles. The author of Ulysses, like Wyndham Lewis, was 6 years older than Tom, but all three had a strong sense of being contemporaries. The observant, reserved novelist of Dublin deeply impressed the shrewd, shy poet from St. Louis. Mr. Joyce was a quiet but rather dogmatic man, and has, as I am convinced most superior persons have, a sense of his own importance. He has a sort of gravity which seems more Protestant than Catholic. He is obviously the man who wrote his books. That is, he impresses you as an important enough personage for that. While detecting an arrogance underlying Irish politeness, Tom liked conversing with Joyce, with whom he dined again on his return journey. By the autumn, Tom decided he needed a specialist in psychological troubles, and Ottoline Morel recommended he travel to Lausanne in Switzerland to consult Dr. Roger Vitoz. Valuing his service, Lloyd's Bank granted 3 months' leave. He was eager to take the new poem he had been writing with him to the tranquillity of Lausanne. While he underwent psychological treatment, material from boyhood came into his head, mixing with his reading and recent sufferings. The section that was to conclude his poem presented suffering and breakdown, also instruction involving control, featuring a voice of authority emanating from a thunderstorm. It was sometimes clear and incantatory, but often a swirling vortex of fragments. There, like an hallucination, is heard the cry of a bird Tom remembered from boyhood.
If there were water and no rock, if there were rock and also water, and water, a spring, a pool among the rock. If there were the sound of water only, not the cicada and dry grass singing, but sound of water over a rock, where the hermit thrush sings in the pine trees. Drip, drop, drip, drop, 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 drop. But there is no water.
Tom left Lausanne for Paris around New Year 1922, having written a poem like no other in the English language. But its final form remained unresolved. It was still a bundle of papers in his luggage. In Paris, Tom and Vivian met Pound's publisher, Horace Liveright, who was visiting. Pound pored over the bundle of papers containing his friend's most recent poetry. Astutely, he opined on the 8th of January that this new work looked damned good, but needed reshaping. Revising and editing continued after Tom returned to London. Pound cut swathes of conventional storytelling. As the drafts were scribbled on and sent back and forth, the poem became more cubist or kaleidoscopic. Now the work began strikingly with April is the cruelest month, and had, at its start, a focus on breeding. Turning convention on its head, Tom's lines present the renewing fertility of spring as painful, not pleasurable. This editor of genius was vital to the wasteland.
Complimenty, you bitch, Pound wrote from Paris on the 24th of January, protesting himself intensely jealous of what had emerged from Tom's manuscripts. By April 1922, Tom had received an offer from Pound's publisher, Liveright, for The Wasteland to be published as a book in the autumn. Tom decided the first two parts of The Wasteland would appear in the first issue of his new magazine, The Criterion, due on the 1st of October, the rest following in issue 2. He sang it, enchanted it, rhymed it, wrote Virginia Woolf, when Tom first read it aloud to her on Sunday the 18th of June 1922. It has great beauty and force and tensity. It was the 15th of December when The Wasteland became an American book. 1,000 copies were printed, each stamped with an individual number. Tom opened the small, pale-jacketed volume in his London flat. Slightly heavier than it looked, underneath the dust jacket, it was bound in black boards with only the words The Wasteland in gold on the front board. The note on the rear flap began, T.S. Eliot was born in 1888 in St. Louis, Missouri. Then went on to hail him as, without question, the most significant of the younger American writers. Tom, weary and very far from the city of his birth, looked at the name T.S. Eliot in plain black print on the title page. It was as if he had never been young.
Tom Mannion was reading from Young Eliot by Robert Crawford. The verse extracts were read by David Acton. It was abridged by Katrin Williams, and the series producer was Duncan Minchell.
The story of Tata, India's global giant, on BBC Radio 4.
Indians are born in Tata hospitals, their houses are held up with Tata steel, and their electricity comes courtesy of the Tata Power Company.
Zarir Massani tells the story of how the Tata Group became Britain's biggest industrial employer.
Tata's success internationally, I think, is also synonymous with India's success too.
But have Tata become too big for their own good and ours?
Tata, India's global giant, this morning at 11, and then available on the BBC Radio 4 website.